بسم الله إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلله فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله يا أيها الذين آمنوا اتقوا الله حق تقاته ولا تموتن إلا وأنتم مسلمون يا أيها الناس اتقوا ربكم الذي خلقكم من نفس واحدة وخلق منها زوجها وبث منهما رجالا كثيرا ونساء واتقوا الله الذي تساءلون به والأرحام إن الله كان عليكم رقيبا يا أيها الذين آمنوا اتقوا الله وقولوا قولا سديدا يصلح لكم أعمالكم ويغفر لكم ذنوبكم ومن يطع الله ورسوله فقد فاز فوزا عظيما أما بعد فإن أصدق الحديث كتاب الله وخير الهدي هدي محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم وشر الأمور محدثاتها وكل محدثة بدعة وكل بدعة ضلالة وكل ضلالة في النار. I'd like to welcome you to this first class of our fiqh session on the 7th of June 1999 corresponding to the 22nd of Safar 1420 Hijriya and inshallah we were going to be covering the basic fiqh, I repeat, basic fiqh of the more important aspects of worship, which will include purification, wudu, salah, zakah, and fasting, sawm. And if we have time, perhaps we'll move on to some of the more aspects of fiqh. Now, before we jump into purification, what exactly is fiqh? Well, linguistically, fiqh means to understand, to reason, okay? So linguistically, fiqh means to understand something from an Arabic perspective. Now, obviously, from an Islamic perspective, fiqh is something else. Fiqh is a study of the rulings of the physical rulings of the Sharia, the physical rulings of the Sharia with their detailed evidences. This is the definition of fiqh. دراسة الأحكام الشرعية العملية من أدلتها التفصيلية. Is that the study of the physical Sharia rulings from or with their detailed evidences. Now when we say physical Sharia rulings, what is this differentiated from? Metaphysical? No. Hypothetical? No. Physical meaning versus spiritual. Okay? So the spiritual rulings are aqidah. Okay? So in fiqh we don't deal with the concept of tawheed, the concept of malaika, the concept of jinn. No. That's why we say the physical rulings, meaning what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has laid down in the Quran and the Sunnah, okay? With their detailed evidences. So we have to go back to the evidence of the Quran and Sunnah and say or see how we get these rulings, how we get these evidences, okay? So this is what fiqh is. Now fiqh covers basically our daily lives, our physical daily lives, okay? This is what fiqh is. I mean, to summarize, I mean, this is what fiqh is. Now obviously the ulama of fiqh, they have to now start off or they have to give a certain methodology in describing fiqh or in writing about fiqh. So what the general trend is that you start off with purification. And we'll get to that in a little while, why we start with purification. Then you move on to wudu. And then you move on to salah. And then you talk about salah, the different types of salah. You know, there are many different types of salah. And then you move on to funeral prayers, salat al-janazah, and how you wash the body and everything. And then they move on to, after salah you have zakah. And then you talk about the obligation of zakah, and who you give zakah to, and how you take out zakah. And then you move on to fasting, sawm, okay? And then you move on to hajj, or how you perform the hajj, when is it obligatory, what is the procedure for hajj. These are called the ibadat, or the pure worship aspects, these four pillars. Obviously the first pillar is the shahada, there's no fiqh with regards to the shahada, it's just a matter of aqidah, right? So then there are four pillars left, right? Salah, zakah, siyam, and hajj. So these four pillars are the first pillars that everyone talks about in the books of fiqh. These are what we're going to do. We're not going to do hajj because inshallah, you know, whenever you guys go for hajj, there are books out available for that. So we're not going to go for hajj in these classes. Now after the scholars, they cover these four things, they then move on to different topics. They discuss jihad, the fiqh of jihad. Who do you fight? Why do you fight? How do you divide the booty of war? They discuss economic transactions. And this is a huge chapter. It deals with, you know, the common selling and trading. What is allowed? What is prohibited? How can you buy fruits that are on the tree? Gifts, inheritance, finding items on the floor. What do you do with them? The whole chapter of economics is a huge chapter of fiqh. Okay, everything that has to do with finances is dealt with in that chapter. After that, they discuss like marriage. Okay, who can you marry? Who can you not marry? What is the procedure for marriage? Okay, the etiquettes of marriage. And then they discuss divorce and the proper procedure for divorce. And then they discuss other ways in which the marriage contract is broken. And so the point is, you realize fiqh is a huge topic which covers every single thing of our lives. How we dress, what we eat, how we eat. Yeah, another chapter of fiqh is what we eat. Okay, perhaps we'll have time to cover that, perhaps we won't. But the point is, how do you sacrifice an animal? Which animals are allowed? Which animals are prohibited? Okay, what is the proper way for tanning? All of these types of topics, they're covered in fiqh. So basically, everything that we do in our daily lives, from when we wake up to when we go to sleep, they're governed by fiqh. Okay, so we see then that fiqh is very, very important, and it's very practical too. So tawheed and all of this is practical, and it's important, but it's more theoretical if you like. You have to know it, and then you have to implement it. Fiqh, on the other hand, you can. It's more, if you like, hands-on. It's more direct. You put it into effect immediately. Okay, that's not to undermine Sahra Tawheed. Tawheed is obviously the purpose of creation. But if you like, there's another way to differentiate, that you can say that Tawheed al-Ibadah, Tawheed of worship, right? There's a conceptual side to it, which is what we're going to do in this book. And then there's a physical side to it, which is what we're going to do in fiqh. In other words, how do you worship Allah? You've understood now, after you've covered Kitab al-Tawheed, inshallah, you've understood now the importance of worshipping Allah and the dangers of worshipping other than Allah and what worship entails. Now the question arises, well, okay, how do I worship Allah? And the primary way is fiqh. When you put fiqh into action, how do you pray? How do you worship, do wudu? How do you do ghusl? Okay, how do you give your zakah? This is the implementation of Tawheed al... What type of Tawheed? Let the brothers answer too much. Well, I know we know. Tawheed al-Uluhiyya, right? Any difference of opinion? Yes, Tawheed al-Uluhiyya is what we put into effect when we study fiqh, okay? Now, what are the sources of fiqh? Now, I understand you're going to have a detailed class on usul al-fiqh or on the sciences of fiqh in a few weeks, but just so that we understand where we're coming from, in a 5-minute summary, what are the sources of fiqh? The first source, obviously, what is the first source? The Quran. The second source, the Sunnah. The third source, Ijma'. What is Ijma'? No. Consensus. In other words, when all of the companions or any generation, they all unite upon something, well, this is what it is. This is what consensus means. Now, consensus means that all of the scholars at that time, they have to have the same opinion. You can't have any difference of opinion. And there are a number of things that are based on Ijma'. What is the fourth most important source? Qiyas. Qiyas. What is Qiyas? Analogy. Okay. In other words, a certain ruling exists in the Quran and Sunnah. Okay. Now there's another aspect or another thing which is very similar to this thing. So we make analogy, we make Qiyas between this which doesn't exist and this which does exist. You're all confused, let me give you an example. Well-known example, which is the most common example too of Qiyas, and inshallah you'll understand what this means. Okay. Marijuana. Is there any Quranic ayah or hadith that specifically prohibits marijuana? No. You know, there's nothing that prohibits it. Now when we look at intoxicants, alcoholic drinks, the Quran clearly prohibits it. And it says the reason it prohibits it is because you lose your mind. Okay? So then there is one ruling, or there is one case, or there is one scenario that exists in the Quran and Sunnah. I.e. alcoholic drinks and their prohibition. Another scenario, marijuana. It doesn't exist. So we make analogy, we make qiyas between alcoholic drinks and marijuana. And we say because alcoholic drinks are prohibited, and they are prohibited because they, you know, cause you to lose your mind and become, without intellect for a short period of time. Likewise, marijuana shares with alcoholic drinks that same reason. So therefore, it must share the same ruling. You understand where I'm coming from? Is that marijuana and alcoholic drinks, okay, beer, spirits, wine, They share the same thing in common in that they make a person lose his mind. Even if it's temporary, they make him lose his mind. They make him do crazy things. It's harmful for the body. So we make qiyas between marijuana and between alcoholic drinks. And we say since alcoholic drinks are prohibited in the Quran and Sunnah, therefore marijuana must also be prohibited in the Quran. This is called qiyas. So this is the fourth important source of Islamic law. Now, there are other sources which inshallah you might study, but these are the four main sources. I just wanted you to know them before we start this class of fiqh. Now, also before we start our classes of fiqh, you should realize that every single action can be put in one of five categories in Islam. Every single action can be put in one of five categories. And we have to define these five categories because we're going to be using them left and right when we come to fiqh. Okay? So there is not a single thing that you can do coming from your, depending, doesn't matter whether it's from salah or zakah or what clothes you wear or walking in the street, whatever you do, every single act can be categorized in one of these five things. The first category is haram. Okay? The first category is that of haram. What does haram mean? Haram means that that act is prohibited from doing. And if you do it, you are sinful. So something that is haram is something that you are prohibited from doing. And if you do it, you are sinful in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I think everyone knows the meaning of haram. The second category is that of makruh. Okay? Makruh means discouraged or disliked. This act, something which is makruh, is something which you are discouraged from doing, but if you do it, you are not sinful. If you do a makruh act, you are not sinful for doing this act. But you are encouraged to not do it. Is that clear? So a makruh act, if you leave a makruh act, you will be rewarded. But if you do it, you will not be sinful. I'm going slow here, so listen carefully. If you leave a makruh act, a disliked act, if you leave a makruh act, you will be rewarded. But if you do it, you will not be sinful. Okay? Is that clear? Whereas a haram act, if you leave it, you're not sinful necessarily. If you leave it, you're not rewarded necessarily. For example, if you don't take interest, are you going to be rewarded for not taking interest? No. Because you're obligated not to take interest. You're obligated to leave fornication. So if you leave it, you are not necessarily rewarded, but you will be sinful if you fall into it. Whereas a makruh act, if you leave it consciously, then you will be rewarded for leaving that act, and you will not be sinful if you fall into it. Are you clear with that or not? You are. Don't be embarrassed. If someone's not clear on something, just stop me and, you know, we'll go over it. With regards to my policy and teaching policy, questions is best to be left towards the end of the lecture. But if you don't understand the concept, right then and there, raise your hand and say, can you repeat it? Okay? So questions of a, you know, related nature, ask them at the end of the class. If you don't understand something, then raise your hand and I'll stop and I'll go over that point. Okay? I don't mind that. That's the second category, makruh, which means that it's discouraged or disliked to do. So therefore, if you leave that discouraged thing, you are rewarded, but if you do it, you are not sinful. The third act, or the third category, excuse me, is that of mubah. Mubah, meem, ba, alif, and ha. Mubah. Okay? A mubah act is one which is neither discouraged or encouraged. So you are neither rewarded or sinful for doing it. Let me give you an example for that. For example, when you woke up in the morning and you put on a blue shirt, okay, did you expect to be rewarded by Allah for putting on a blue shirt instead of a red one? No. Did you expect to be punished? No. It's mubah. It doesn't matter what you wear, as long as the certain conditions are met. But what you wear, is it blue or red or green, it doesn't matter. So this is mubah. It's allowed. And most of our acts of our daily life fall under mubah. Eating and drinking, and, you know, sleeping and, you know, taking a walk in the forest, all these type of things are mubah. They're allowed. In other words, you're not rewarded for doing it, but you're not sinful, and you're not sinful for doing it at the same time. Okay? Neither reward nor sin. It's just allowed. Okay? The fourth category is mustahab, or encouraged. The fourth category is mustahab, or encouraged. And this category basically is any act that a person who does it will be rewarded, but if he leaves it, he's not going to be sinful. Any act that a person, if he does it, he's going to get reward from Allah. But if he leaves it, he's not going to be sinful. Okay? For example, praying the sunnah prayers, like Dhuhr has two sunnahs, four sunnahs, like that. The sunnah prayers, okay? This is mustahab. If you pray it, it's good for you. You're going to get reward, and you're encouraged to pray it. Mustahab means encouraged, it's rewarded. Okay? But if you leave that sunnah prayer, no one's going to say that you're sinful for leaving the sunnah prayer. Okay? So it's encouraged to do, but if you leave it, it's not a sin. Clear? Okay, the last category, obviously, is wajib, obligatory. Which means that you are obligated, you are obliged to do that act. It is obligatory upon you, it is mandatory upon you to do that act. And if you do it, you are rewarded. If you leave it, you are sinful. If you do it, you are rewarded, like your five daily prayers, the fard. Okay, you have to wake up for Fajr and pray Fajr on time, two rak'ahs. If you do it, you're rewarded. If you leave it, then you are sinful. This is wajib. Okay? So the fiqh now is basically the categorization of all of our acts into one of these five categories. Okay? So we define what is wajib, we define what is mustahab, we define what is mubah. Actually, mubah is everything. Everything is mubah unless we categorize it otherwise. Okay? Once we define what is wajib and what is mustahab and what is makruh and what is haram, everything that is left falls under mubah, which means there is no ruling regarding it. You're allowed to do it. Wearing glasses or contacts. Okay? I mean, you know, choosing a job at Dow Chemical or BASF or whatever. Doesn't matter. It's mubah. You know what I'm saying? Mubah means it's allowed. It's allowed. Neither is it encouraged nor is it discouraged. Okay? It's just, it's allowed. Okay? You don't get a reward for doing it, and you don't get a sin for doing it. Where do you want to work? You want to work at Pizza Hut or McDonald's, as long as there's no pork or bacon involved. But I'm general. I mean, you know, just, what do you want to do for a living? You want to be an engineer or do you want to be a doctor? It's mubah. It's up to you. It's mubah. So most of the acts of our daily life, they fall under mubah. Everything that we define as haram and wajib and makruh and mustahab, we're going to define them. Well, if we were to take a full class, this whole book, for example, we'd define them. But, you know, the point of fiqh is to categorize all of your acts into one of these five things. Okay, there's another way you can look at fiqh. Now, my methodology in teaching fiqh will basically be, we're going to teach fiqh at a very, very basic level. The reason being that we have a time factor involved. We only have, you know, maybe 20 lectures or so. Okay. Also, you know, most of us sitting here have not studied fiqh before, so we're not qualified to discuss the various different opinions. Well, this imam said this, this madhab said that, this. We don't have time for that. You know, we just have to quickly go over and understand what we're doing. Okay. Also, perhaps I'm not, you know, the best person to teach you this type of fiqh. You need an advanced scholar to teach you these type of detailed fiqh. You know, but primarily it's due to our time factor that we don't have enough time to cover that. So basically, that basically means we have to choose a certain book or a certain scholar or a certain madhab to teach you, okay? And I want you to realize, all of you or most of you know, that there are four madhabs in existence today. Historically, there are four. And there have been many more before, right? But there are four primary madhabs, okay? Now, it's allowed and encouraged to study one of these madhabs, at least one of them, okay? But it is not mandatory to take one madhab as your madhab. It is not mandatory that I have to choose one of these four and for the rest of my life, I have to just blindly follow what this madhab says. No. It's just a stepping stone in your process to study fiqh. Is that you choose a madhab, you study what this madhab says about fiqh. Because you know that there are various philosophies, or various ways of fiqh, right? And we don't have time to get into the details of that. But inshallah, I understand the last week, the weekend course and the evening courses will be devoted to the science of fiqh. So then you will understand why these differences exist, why these madhabs exist, where do they differ in, how are they different from each other. Right now we don't have the time to get into this. So inshallah, last week you will be exposed to that type of knowledge. But my point is, I have decided to choose the Hanbali madhab in particular to teach you these basic courses of fiqh. And I'd like to point out over and over again, this is just a stepping stone. It's just a stepping stone. Doesn't mean that now that you've heard me say this, for the rest of your lives you're going to follow it. No. Inshallah, I encourage you to go and research, to go and ask the scholars, to read up more about the evidences, but just so that we can quickly breeze over some topics, quickly understand what fiqh is about. Many people don't even know. For example, we talk about the types of water, which we're going to talk about today. What do you mean the types of water? How type H2O? I mean, there's only one, isn't there? Ionized and deionized. They don't understand where we're coming from. So at least if they go over one, if you like, madhab or one philosophy, at least they know this thing exists, they understand it. Now they are better qualified to go and study fiqh more and in more detail. Okay? So please understand, and you know, I'm emphasizing over and over again, what I say in this class is not like the final authority or the final word on the matter. No. We're just quickly, you know, breezing over some aspects of fiqh. I want you to understand that this is just a stepping stone. And the reason I chose the Hanbali madhab is because I feel more comfortable with it. And also because I have the books to do that. And also because many of the ulama, such as Shaykh Ibn Baz and Shaykh Uthaymeen, they used to advise, and they advise the people that when they start studying, they should start with the Hanbali madhab. Because it's the most involved with hadith. It's the most directly goes back to the Quran and Sunnah. You know, so because of those factors and others, we'll just quickly start off. We'll start off, inshallah, with the Hanbali madhab, and we're going to continue with that for the next 3 or 4 weeks. But again and again, I don't expect you to take this madhab. I don't expect you to, for the rest of your life, follow it blindly. No, it is in fact incorrect to follow a madhab blindly, which inshallah you'll be taught in the last week of your classes. With that, inshallah, we'll start with the chapter of purification. It's a short chapter. We'll finish it, inshallah, in a short while. Another point before I start is that I'm going to talk about fiqh in a practical manner, which means I'm going to delete many topics which the scholars of the past discussed that were relevant to them. For example, the chapter of Tahara, we discuss a lot about, it is usually discussed about wells and about, you know, ponds and lakes. We don't have to do with that because we get water from the tap usually, you know. So I'm just going to these type of topics that were relevant in the past but not that relevant now, I'm just going to delete them or ignore them and move on to stuff which is more practical. You know? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Someone needs to use the restroom. He doesn't need to ask permission from me. Just go ahead. We start off with the chapter of purification or the chapter of water. Okay. Now, why do we start off with water? Why do the books of fiqh start off with a chapter concerning water? The reason is very simple. What is the most important act of worship that a Muslim does in his day? Salah, prayer, right? The most important act of worship is prayer, okay? Now, how does one enter into a state of prayer, or into a state of that he's qualified to pray? By wudu. And what is wudu based upon? Water. So you see, when you follow the sequence of events backwards, you realize that that when a person, for example, wakes up in the morning, he has to offer his fajr prayer, what is the first thing he has to do is go and make wudu. So obviously we have to discuss about water. What water is going to make wudu with, and what water he cannot make wudu with. Okay? So this is why the books of fiqh, they start off with the chapter of water. Now, know that water, and to be more precise, fluids are classified into three categories, from a fiqh perspective. Three categories. Every single fluid, from Diet Coke to Pepsi, from water to every single fluid you want, you can classify it into one of three categories. Okay? The first category is called Tahur. Tahur. Ta-ha, waw, ra. Tahur. Okay? This, under this comes natural water. In other words, the only thing that is tahur is natural water. What do I mean by natural water? I mean water that has been unpolluted. Water that comes down from the skies. Water that is in the lakes and ponds. Water that we open our taps with. This is unpolluted water. Okay? When we turn on the tap, pure water comes out. This is water, H2O. You know, this is unpolluted. You don't have any substances in it that changes it to another subject, to another substance. Okay? So, tahur water, the definition of tahur water is that type of water that purifies, that type of water that is pure in and of itself and purifies other objects. This is the definition of tahur. The tahur water is water that is pure in and of itself and it purifies other objects. So if you were to touch this tahur water, your hand would not become dirty, would not become impure. Why? Because this water is pure in and of itself. Likewise, you can purify yourself with it. So there's two aspects of tahur water. Firstly, it is pure in and of itself. You can drink it, eat it, wash yourself in it. Okay. Secondly, it removes impurities from you. It purifies other objects. So in other words, you can perform wudu, you can perform ghusl with it. So this is the second aspect of tahur water. You understand the two aspects. Firstly, it's pure in and of itself. Secondly, it purifies other objects. Okay? The proof for this is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, وَأَنزَلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً طَهُورًا. That we have revealed from the skies pure water, tahur water. So obviously, the water that comes down from the skies, every one of you has studied the water cycle. Basically, everything from the ponds to the lakes to the streams, all of it comes from the rain. And then it goes back to the rain. It's a big cycle. So the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions one part of the cycle as being pure automatically implies that this whole cycle of water, that when water comes down, it's absorbed into the earth, and then rivers and wells are formed from that water, and then rivers and streams and oceans and lakes, all of this has come forth from the rain. All of this shows that the natural water in its natural state is tahur. In other words, it is pure in and of itself, and it can purify other objects. Likewise, the Prophet ﷺ said in one hadith that إِنَّ الْمَاءَ طَهُورِ, that water is tahur. And it never becomes impure. Nothing impurifies water. In other words, water, like you have it, it is pure. So you can, it is pure in and of itself, and it purifies other things. So is that clear? The first category of fluids is pure water. In other words, tahur water. The second category of fluids is tahir. Not tahur, but tahir. Ta, alif, ha, and ra. Tahir fluids. Now the definition of tahir fluids is every fluid that is pure in and of itself, but does not purify other objects. How does this differ from tahur? What does tahur do? It purifies other objects. Tahir, it doesn't purify other objects. Okay? So for example, under tahir water, under tahir fluid, for example, are the fluids that we use for eating and drinking. Okay? Pepsi, 7-Up, Diet Coke, Tang, orange juice, Gatorade, whatever you want. These are tahir. They are pure in and of themselves, but you can't do wudu with Gatorade. You can't do wudu with Pepsi. Okay? Why? Because it's tahir. Now we're going to discuss now how we get from tahir to that. First, I just want to explain to you the three categories, and then we're going to discuss them in more detail. So does everyone understand what tahir is? Is that these are those fluids which are pure in and of themselves. So you can drink and eat these fluids if you want to. I mean, not every thought and fluid you'll want to drink, but I'm saying you can drink these fluids, you can eat them, they can fall on your clothes, okay? You can spill something on you and you can still pray. It's getting late in the day, I'm getting a bit tongue-y and a bit tired. You can still pray with that fluid on your body. So if some Pepsi falls on you, for example, okay? You don't have to wash that portion. Jazakallah khair. You don't have to wash that portion. It's tahur, mashallah. You don't have to wash that portion where the Pepsi falls before you pray, because it's tahir. So it doesn't impurify. It's not impure, but you can't perform wudu with Pepsi. So you see the difference between tahir and tahur? Yes, no? If anyone's unclear now, you know, say so before we move on. But the third category of fluids is najis fluids. Najis, meaning impure fluids. Okay? Now, najis is that which is impure in and of itself. So obviously, it cannot purify other things. Najis is an object or a fluid which is impure. It could be a fluid, it could be a solid object, which is impure in and of itself. So obviously, if it's impure, how can it purify other things? I mean, it's understood. When you say it's impure, so for example, human urine, okay? Human feces and stool, okay? This is najis. So if something of najis with a seen, if something of a najis falls on you, then you have to take it off before you pray. So if some urine falls on you, you cannot pray in those clothes where that urine has fallen. Okay? You have to go and wash it. With tahur or tahir? What are you going to wash it with? Tahur, not tahir. Because tahir doesn't purify other things. Remember, tahur is the thing that purifies other things. Tahir doesn't purify other things. Okay? So you understand what tahur is, you understand what tahir is, and you understand what najis is. Everyone's clear with that? Okay, the question arises, how does water come from tahur to tahir to najis? What changes water from tahur to tahir to najis? We just said natural water is tahur. You turn the tap on and it's pure water, it's tahur. Okay? Water that's found in the wells, that's found in you buy it from the shops, found in the oceans, all of this is tahur. But obviously, how does it change from tahur to tahir? Because obviously everything is based from water. How does it change from tahur to tahir? The change that occurs, or the criterion for this change, is very simple. Suppose you were to add something to tahur water. Let me give you a practical example, tang, okay? You have a bucket, a big bucket of pure water. If you were to add a little spoon or a tablespoon of tang in this whole bucket, and mix it in, would you be able to detect any change? Yes or no? I would say no. If you have a big bucket, and you added a little tablespoon of tang, right? I don't think you'd detect any change. And you'd still call that thing water, right? I mean, if you add a little bit of tang into it, it's not gonna change anything in the water. But still, you're still gonna call it water. But if you were to continue adding tang to it, eventually, that water would become from tahir to tahur. Eventually, you'd stop calling that thing water, and you start calling it tang. Okay? Now, when does this break point come? Well, there is no precise definition. It's basically what you would call water and what you would call tang. There's no precise break point. Is that, okay, after you add this many milligrams of a certain substance. So how do you change from tahur to tahir? Is when you would stop calling that object water and you would start calling it something else. Likewise with Pepsi, okay? Pepsi, for example. Pepsi, for those of you that work in the restaurant industry, you know that it's sold as a very concentrated sugar or syrup, okay? And they add water to it. Okay, they add water to it and then they carbonate it, so that's where you get your fizzy drinks when you go to the restaurant, okay? A little bit of that sugar, a little bit of that syrup, if you were to add it to a large amount of water, it would not change anything and you would still call it water. But eventually, as you added more and more syrup to that water, eventually you would stop calling it water and you say, okay, this is Pepsi. Or even diluted Pepsi, but you wouldn't call it water. Okay? When does this exact precise change come? There is no exact precise time point. Before this, it's water. Before that, but it basically goes back to your judgment. Would you call this substance water or not? Likewise, soap. Okay? You add a little bit of soap to a lot of water, it might get a little bit of soapy, but you'll still consider that thing water. If you add a lot, eventually it'll change and become another substance. Okay? So again, there is no fine criteria that you can use. There is no pinpoint place that you can say, before this is tahur, after this is tahir. It's basically, it goes back to your own self. Would you call that object water, or would you call it something else? Would you call it Pepsi, or Tang, or Gatorade, or whatever you want to call it? Okay? As soon as you think that this object is now no longer water, then you cannot perform wudu with this water. Okay? So if something small falls into the water, for example, leaves, this doesn't change the water at all. So it's always going to remain tahur. Likewise, a little bit of sand, it doesn't change the water at all. You're still going to call it water. You might call it dirty water, but it's still water. Muddy water, but it's still water. So you can perform wudu with this type of water. Likewise, sometimes when we turn the tap on and we find the water is slightly red because of lead deposits, right? This is tahur water because you still call that substance water. It might be a little bit polluted. It might be changed. It might have changed its color, but you still consider that substance water. So you can perform wudu with that type of water. Likewise, the ocean, it has salt in it, but you still consider it water. Salty water, but it's water. Okay, so you can't perform wudu with that type of substance. So what I'm saying is the criterion between tahur and tahir, it goes back to basically yourself. Okay, it goes back to your intelligence. I mean, would you consider this water or not? If you consider it water, it is, you can perform wudu with it. If you consider it as something else besides water, then it is pure. It is pure if you've added something pure to it, but you cannot perform wudu with it. Is that clear so far? Clear? Mm-hmm. No, we're going to get to that in a while about fasting and performing a wudu while fasting. It doesn't break your wudu. Yeah. Yeah, okay. The question is, I define tahur as pure water. Now, if we add something, it becomes slightly impure. What do I mean by pure? I mean not pure from a, if you like, our sense. I mean pure from a Sharia sense, from the sense that in the religion of Islam, this water is pure. In other words, if it falls on you, you don't have to wash it to pray. I don't mean pure from a sense that's absolutely, undiluted, and no chemicals. I don't mean pure from a chemical perspective, if you like. I mean pure from an Islamic perspective. Meaning that when I say something is pure, it means that the Sharia, or the religion of Allah, has classified this substance as pure. In that, if it falls on you, or if you have a little bit of this substance on you, you can still pray and there's no problem with it. Okay? So if you have some Pepsi or some fluids or some type of stuff on you, you can still pray in those type of clothes. It's not, versus, for example, najis, which is what we're going to get to now. Najis is everything that is impure. So, for example, human urine and human feces and stool, okay? And pigs and the urine and feces of those animals that are not eaten, okay? Those animals that are not eaten, such as the dog, such as all carnivorous animals, okay? All of these things are najis. Okay, you might want to write these type of things down. Is that human feces, human stool, pig, everything to do with pigs is najis. Everything to do with pigs is najis. The saliva of the dog, every urine and stool that comes from an animal that you are not allowed to eat. So, for example, cow urine, is that najis? No, cow urine is not najis. Okay? Sheep urine, sheep stool is not najis. Okay? Pigeon, for example, pigeon droppings are not najis. Okay? So if you're praying and a pigeon dropping falls on you, you don't have to break your prayer. Versus, for example, if a human urine or something fell on you, you cannot continue praying with those type of clothes. Okay? So you see the difference. Those type of animals, which you're allowed to eat, their urine and stool is pure. Whereas those type of animals that you're prohibited from eating, their urine and stool is impure. Okay? So these type of things are all najis. Questions at the end. Do you understand something? Okay. These type of things, they're all qualified as najis. Now, how does water change from tahur to najis? Here there is a fine point. Here there is a pinpoint that you can say before this is tahur, before this is najis. Unlike from tahur to tahir. When you add, this is now the definition of, or not definition, but when you can qualify something or classify something as najis. When you add to tahur water or to tahir water, when you add a najis, we've already defined some of the most important najasa, right? When you add a najis substance, until either its color, or its taste, or its smell changes, then that water will be classified as najis. And it leaves being water and it becomes najis. So you have, for example, a bucket of water, okay? Now, suppose you're doing some experiment, let's say, because how else would you do this? Suppose you add a few drops of urine to this big bucket, okay, of human urine. Neither will the color change, nor the smell change, nor the taste change. Okay? So, you could still do wudu with that water. I'm not advising you to do it, right? But I'm saying, were you to perform wudu with that water, your wudu would be acceptable. You understand where I'm coming from? I'm not saying you should do wudu with that water, but I'm saying if you were to do so, or were you forced in a situation to do wudu with that water, then your wudu would be acceptable. Whereas, for example, if you added a whole cup of urine, then the smell would change, and or the color would change, and or the taste would change. If any one of these three changes, or all three things change, then that bucket becomes impure, becomes najis. So if you were in the middle of the desert, and you only had this bucket of water with you, you could still not perform wudu with that water, and you would have to do tayammum, which we're going to get to also in a little while. So you understand where I'm coming from, is that there is a clear pinpoint between tahur and najis, whereas there is no clear pinpoint between tahur and tahir. Okay, there's three aspects. Any one of these three things that are changed, this will change the water from tahur to najis. If there's more than one, all the better. But if any one of these three things is changed, then that water becomes najis. When you add a najis substance, we already defined the most important najis substances, and there are more. For example, blood. Blood is a najis substance. Okay, you add blood, or human urine, or human species, or stool, or anything, to a tahur fluid, until either its taste is changed, or its color is changed, or its smell, or any of the three, or more than the three. It doesn't matter. The point is, at least one of these three things has to be changed. Okay? When you can detect a color change, or a smell change, or a taste change, right then and there, at that point, that water changes from tahur to tahir. Tahur to najis. Okay? Any one of these three things. Color, taste, or smell. Okay? Now this is based on the ijma' of the Muslim scholars. This is what we're saying. The evidence for this is the ijma' or the unanimous consensus of all the Muslim scholars. They all held the same opinion. Is that no matter how small the water is, it's in this cup or it's as big as an ocean. Okay, or not as an ocean can never become najis. I mean, you know this, you know. No matter what happens, the ocean has so much water, it'll clear it away. Okay, but suppose as big as this room, a container full of water. If you added any najis substance to this cup or to this container of water, the criterion will still be the same. As soon as one of these three things changes, either the taste, or the color, or the smell. When that changes, then that water becomes najis. Okay? That's clear enough, right? Now, obviously, it is discouraged from performing wudu from a small amount of water in which a najis has fallen into. So, for example, you have a bucket of water, and you want to do ghusl, and you know that, for example, a child came and urinated in that. Okay? Now, it didn't change any of these three things, but obviously, it's discouraged. It's disliked. It's makruh to do water from that, to do wudu or ghusl from that type of water. You understand this point, right? The proof of this is the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ reported by Abu Dawud, in which he said, when water reaches two qullas, we're going to define qullas in a little while. When water reaches two qullas, then it can never become najis. So a qulla is a huge amount of water. It basically is around 150 or something kilograms. That's a huge amount of water, huge amount of weight of water. You know, one qulla. So two is going to be double that. I mean, point is, it's a huge amount of water. And the scholars have differed about the exact transformation of qulla to our modern system. But the point is, they all agree it's a huge amount of water. So the Prophet said, when water is more than two qullas, like a big lake or a pond or a swimming pool, for example, okay, then it will never become najis. So what does this mean? It means if it's less than two qullas, like a small amount, it'll become najis fast. It'll become najis faster. Okay? So if you have a small amount like this cup or a bucket, then if some najis falls into it, then it's discouraged to perform wudu from these type of waters. But it's not haram, it's not prohibited. Why? Because one of these three things has not changed yet. When one of these three things changes, then the water changes from tahur to najis, and it becomes haram to perform wudu with this type of water. Is that clear, or am I losing you guys? Is it clear? Okay. Another point is, extremely large bodies of water can never become najis. Never become najis. For example, oceans, large lakes, and this is well known by experience. No matter how big an oil spill occurs, for example, it's never going to make the whole water najis. This is something, one of the miracles of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. No matter what you do, and many countries, they still just, their gutters, they literally just go into the oceans, you know. So the question arises, can I do wudu from that ocean? The answer is, of course. large bodies of water never become najis. Never become najis. Okay? Now obviously, if you're in one part of that ocean where you can see the najasa, or you can, then obviously the hukum or the ruling is different. But I'm talking about if you're on the other side of the ocean or another beach. For example, they have the sewage system is being expelled from one beach, and you're at another beach 2 miles away. Okay, you can't taste or see or smell any difference. That water is pure for you. You don't have to concern yourself, well, there's a sewage line draining into the ocean there. Why? Because large bodies of water never become najis. Okay, in its entirety, they never become najis. Another point is flowing or running water also doesn't become najis. Okay, so if you're at a stream and it's running and it's flowing, you don't have to be concerned, or is someone urinating on top of that stream? You don't have to think about this. Because if it's flowing water, it's never going to become najis. Okay? Flowing water does not become najis. Let's see what else is there before we finish. We already mentioned that one of the most... we already mentioned some of the more important najasa, some of the more important najis objects. But you should realize that certain objects are more najis than others. Okay? Amongst them is pigs. Pigs are, they are always najis. It doesn't matter how much you wash them, they're always going to be najis. You can pour all of the water of all of the oceans on a pig, it'll still be najis. Okay? Doesn't matter. The pig is najis in and of itself. Likewise, dog saliva. Saliva of the dog. The Prophet said that if a dog licks in one of your vessels, or sips in one of your vessels, then throw that water out and wash that water 7 times. Wash that vessel 7 times. The first time with sand. Okay, so saliva of the dog is an extremely dirty najis. Okay, this, for example, if someone were to urinate in a bowl, you don't have to wash it 7 times. You just wash it once, clean it, purify it, and it's clean. But dog saliva in particular is more najis than other aspects, or other things too. Okay, likewise, menstrual blood is also a very extreme najasa. The Prophet said if a woman sees that menstrual blood on her, then she should scrape off, when it's dry, you should scrape off the blood and wash it with water and then rinse it also with water. So it's a type of najasa which she cannot pray in if there is some type of blood on her of that nature. Likewise, another thing that is impure or that is najis is seminal fluid of the males and also of the females actually. They both have, pre-seminal fluid, right? Pre-seminal fluid. We call it in Arabic mazi. This is the fluid that is released when a person is in a state of sexual excitement. This type of fluid is released. Okay, this is before the actual sperm of the male is released. That this type of fluid is called pre-seminal fluid. Likewise, women also have this type of fluid expelled from them. This type of fluid is najis. Okay, so if a person, now this is very relevant. I'd like to point out before we get here, the brother should not be embarrassed, neither the sisters, when we discuss these type of things. You guys have to know this stuff. This, you know, your lives revolve around this stuff, okay? So the brother should not be embarrassed, neither should the sisters be embarrassed when we mention these type of things. The Prophet ﷺ, he praised the woman that came and asked him about the wet dream, that she had a wet dream. And Aisha, she said, how can a woman have a wet dream? So the Prophet ﷺ rebuked Aisha. He rebuked Aisha. And he praised that woman for not having any shyness in asking these type of things. Because the women and the men, they have to know these type of rulings. They might seem a bit embarrassing, right? But you should realize this is your religion that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed to you. You have to know these types of things. How should we deal with these types of situations? So don't feel embarrassed, and above all, be mature. And you know, inshallah, all of you are mature, inshallah. Don't crack jokes or anything. This is not the topic or the place or the time to do this, okay? So pre-seminal fluid, we said, is najis. Pre-seminal fluid is najis. So if a brother, for example, feels that this type of fluid is exerted, emitted from him, and this type of fluid is only emitted when a person is in a state of arousal. Okay, when this fluid is emitted from him, then he must go and wash. If you're, for example, he's wearing underwear, or the sister, they must go and wash that clothes, and they cannot pray in that clothes, in that cloth, if it exited outside. Okay. Likewise, they have to wash the place that it came out of, like the private parts. They have to wash it with water. The entire private place, they have to wash it with water. Because a najis came out. And this is proven in the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, when Ali ibn Abi Talib, he asked the Prophet ﷺ, I am a young man, and a lot of madi, a lot of this type of pre-seminal fluid is exerted from me. So what should I do? So the Prophet ﷺ told him that throw a handful of water on your clothes, in other words, where it falls, and then wash your private parts. Entirely, including, for example, the testicles all the way to the top, you have to wash all of it. Okay. Likewise, for the sister, they should wash their private parts also if this type of fluid comes up. This is najis. Okay. Now the question arises: is the seminal fluid itself najis? We all said the pre-seminal fluid, it is najis, for sure. How about the sperm itself? How about what is released during the orgasm, during the sperm itself? Is that najis? Now, there's a difference of opinion here, but the correct opinion is that that fluid is not najis. That fluid is not najis. Okay? Now, this obviously applies only to the men. That fluid is not najis. And the proof for this is the hadith that is found in Sahih Bukhari, in which the Aisha said that sometimes I would see the traces of the Prophet's, the sperm on his clothes, and he would be going to the masjid. And so I would just scratch it out. Okay? I would just scratch it out. That's it. So the very fact that she didn't wash it, and the very fact that the Prophet himself did not wash it, shows that it's not najis. Okay? So the sperm itself, and like I said, there is an ikhtilaf, but the correct opinion is that the sperm itself is not najis. But the pre-seminal fluid is. The pre-seminal fluid for the man and the woman, it is najis. Now there is one exception to human urine. And that is the urine of an unweaned male infant. The urine of an unweaned male infant is not najis. How about an unweaned female infant? It is najis. Okay? What is an unweaned? What does it mean, unweaned? It means that his primary or his main source of food is his mother's milk. Okay? In other words, a year old, a few months old. Okay? And this is proven in the hadith of the Prophet when a male boy was brought to him, and the boy urinated on the Prophet's clothing. So the mother became flustered, and obviously she was embarrassed. The Prophet told her to calm down, and he asked for some water to be brought, and he just splashed that water on him. He didn't wash it. He just splashed it. In other words, you take some water like this, and then you just drop it on you, like that. Okay. Whereas, had it been najis, then you have to wash it all the way. So the urine of an unweaned male boy, all you have to do is just throw some water on it. That's it. You don't have to wash it and rub it and scrub it. Unlike had it been real urine, you would have to actually wash the clothes. Okay. However, the urine of a female infant, it is najis. And this is proven in the hadith that the Prophet clearly said that the urine of a male boy, the male unweaned boy, you just throw water on it. And the urine of a female girl or a female baby must be washed. Okay, this is in Abu Dawud and other books of hadith. Now, why this is the case, we don't know. We don't ask. Many scholars have given reasons, the difference between the man and the woman. And to be honest, all of these reasons have their flaws with them. So we don't ask why. We just accept it. The Prophet said it, Allah said it, it's good enough for us. So the Prophet told us that for the male, unweaned male boys, if it's weaned, then it becomes najis. If he's eating food, if he's eating solids, then it becomes najis. Just like a full-grown man, okay? But if he's unweaned, if he's younger than, he's still feeding on his mother's milk, at this point in time, his urine, all you have to do is just throw some water on it, splash some water on it. So this is an exception to human urine. Likewise, vomit and large amounts of blood, this also is considered najis. However, the scholars have said that a very small amount, can be forgiven of blood. For example, nasal blood when it just comes out, okay? Likewise, a small amount of pre-seminal fluid. Because it's something which, very few people can save themselves from. Just a small amount of pre-seminal fluid. And everyone knows what a small amount is. Maybe like in a little bit, But if someone is continually discharging, that's the word I'm looking for. Discharging pre-seminal fluid, then this is not a small amount. Everyone knows what a small amount is. Just like, a little bit, okay? So the scholars say, this is forgiven. You don't have to worry about it, But a large amount, or not necessarily large, but more than a small amount, okay? This is not forgiven. So a small amount of blood, a small amount of pre-seminal fluid is forgiven. But a large amount, it is not forgiven. I think we've covered basically taharat and najasat. The reason we're doing this is we want to realize, again, why are we doing this? We want to realize what water we can use to perform wudu and ghusl. We're going to get to wudu and ghusl in a few chapters or in a few lectures. Right now, we're just concerned with what waters can we use. What can I do wudu and ghusl with? So we have to realize then that we can only do wudu and ghusl with pure water. And also, if we have a najis substance on us, we can only wash it with water. Likewise, now we obviously when our washing machines, we have water and soap, that's fine. But there is water, that's the point. There is water. Okay? So you have to wash it with water is the point. You have to remove that thing. Likewise, it's common sense that if a physical impurity is there, for example, human feces, right? Obviously, you have to remove that feces. For example, if a child defecates in the masjid, right? Obviously, you have to remove that actual physical thing from the masjid before you can clean it. It's understood. You have to remove it. Likewise, on your clothes, if some amount of blood falls or urine falls, not urine, but like stool or something, you have to physically remove if it's a solid object. If it's a liquid object, like urine, then all you have to do is pour water on it, throw water on it. Okay? Likewise, for example, in the masjid, a child comes and urinates in the masjid. Okay? What should you do? Well, if you're in a masjid that doesn't have a carpet, like it's sand, obviously you just, you can pour water on it or take the sand away or pour water on it. Okay? But if it's a carpeted masjid like this, then you just add enough water until you think that you've cleaned the najasa. It's up to you. I mean, it's your human sense, you know. There's no ratio that you use, 1 to 2 or 1 to... There's no ratio like that, okay? You just use your common sense until you think that you have cleaned the najasa away from the masjid. And this is proven by the hadith of the Prophet in which a Bedouin came and he urinated in the masjid. Now, the Bedouins, they are known for their crudeness and they're not very cultured and refined, okay? So he just came and urinated in the masjid. So the people became angry at the Bedouin. The Prophet said, leave him alone, let him urinate. And this shows you the wisdom of the Prophet. A person cannot interrupt his urine. Everyone knows this. A person cannot stop his urine. You know, urinate for 10 seconds and stop for 3-4 minutes and urinate. He cannot do this, okay? Imagine the hardships that would have been caused to this Bedouin. The Bedouin already started urinating. So what's the point of stopping him now? Likewise, had he been told to exit the masjid, then his urine would have continued all the way to the masjid. So that najasa would have spread all the way. So this is the wisdom of the Prophet. He told the companion, stop. You know, don't force him to stop. Let him continue. You can't do anything. And if you're going to try to stop him, you're going to cause a bigger hassle. So when he finished urinating, the Prophet ﷺ called him and said, this is the Masjid of Allah, and the Masjid of Allah are not built for these type of things. Okay? And then he ordered the companions to take a bucket of water and throw it on the urine. So this shows you then that liquids, fluids, all you have to do is wash it away. Just throw water and wash it away. Likewise, if urine falls on your clothes, just wash it with water. That's it. But solids, on the other hand, you have to remove the actual physical thing. Okay? If it's stool or if it's blood, menstrual blood. Like the Prophet said in the menstrual blood hadith, he said, scrape it away. He told the woman, scrape it away first. Okay? And then wash it and rub it with water and then throw water on it. And then if there's a sign or a redness left after that, he said you can ignore that because you've done your job. So even if there's a color left, whatever you do after you've purified it, you can ignore from that. You don't have to worry about it. Okay. Likewise, when it comes to feces, for example, suppose you did your best to wipe it away, you washed it, but there was still some color left of it. This is ignored. You can now, because you've done your job, you've washed it, you've rubbed it, you've scraped it, you can't do anything more, you can ignore it. Because you've done your job. And this is of the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He didn't make it so strict for us. You know? And for example, women's blood, it's very difficult to remove the stain from that. Okay? And the sisters know this, it's very difficult to remove the stain. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has forgiven this from us. That once you've done that, once you've done your job, you've scraped away the najasa, you've washed it rigorously, you've thrown the water on it, and that's it. After that, you can leave the rest. Whatever, if there's still some stain or some there, you can leave it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and you are forgiven for that. Inshallah, I think we've covered the more important najasa. This wasn't an exhaustive list, there's others also, but I'm saying the more important ones are these. And from tomorrow, inshallah, we might start about wudu or the rest from one of the two, inshallah. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika wa la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Any questions, the sisters can pass them down there and the brothers can write. When there are no questions, it seems that the people didn't understand anything. Because if you understand, that's when you have questions. My teachers, they used to say, if the students don't ask questions, something is wrong. Because only when you really understand what's going on, that's when other questions are going to arise. Well, how about this? How about that? Okay? So, keep that in mind. No, I didn't mention about the water cycle. I'm saying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions that we have revealed from the skies, or we have sent down from the skies, pure water. So I'm saying we all know the water cycle, okay? The very fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions one section of this cycle as being pure, automatically implies the rest of it is also pure. Because we know the water cycle from the rain, we get the wells, we get the springs, we get the waters, we get the rivers, we get the streams, we get the oceans, lakes. So if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala calls the water that comes down from the sky is pure, obviously everything that follows from that will also be pure. That was my point. Just the sisters, they have questions, they can put it under the thing, yeah. The brother's asking if there's a brother. If there's a najis that has fallen on the carpet of the masjid or something, someone urinated. After you wash it, can you pray on it? Yes, of course. after you wash it, after you throw the water on it. Because the Bedouin, he did this in the Prophet's masjid. The Bedouin did this in the Prophet's masjid, despite that fact, the companions used to pray in that place after the incident was over. Yeah. Like the one from the sister. Is it possible to turn najis back to fahur? Really, this is a very controversial issue in these days, because you have to realize in the old times this type of stuff didn't exist, the chemical procedures for changing. But I do know that the majority of the scholars of our times, they claim that the what do you call the purification process that the cities, they do with the sewer systems and they turn it back to water, they said this is allowed. They said this particularly is allowed. Okay, so for example, you know the filtration process where they go through, and there's chemical process where they reconvert the najis into tahur. Okay, I do know that the ulama of our times, the committee of fiqh in Rabat al-Alam al-Islami, which was headed by Shaykh Ibn Baz rahimahullah and others, they allowed this type of water and they said it is tahur. But in general, most of the scholars say najis cannot be transferred back to tahur. This is what most of the scholars say. But this has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And by the way, the sister that asked the question, the implications for this question are very many. Amongst them is, for example, extracting chemicals from animals. Okay, for example, what do you call it? Enzymes and these type of things. When they take the enzymes from, for example, pigs and dogs and other animals and then use them in food. Now, chemically, that substance is transformed 180 degrees. It's totally gone from what it used to be. But it's still based on that najasa. So this question is, in fact, related to that. And the scholars have differed about that. Most of them say, no, it doesn't make it halal, even though it has chemically been transformed. And some say it is allowed. But I do know that, in particular, with regards to this process of changing sewer water and the gutter water back to tahur water, I do know that the ulama, the majority of them in this time, they allow it. Okay. Huh? One more question. That shrimp is makruh. It was in one drop of blood falling up. What do you think? Okay, there's a question about urination, and that will be discussed in the next lecture, inshallah. There's a question about shrimp, that too will be discussed in the next lecture, inshallah. No mixing between the two. The last question I will answer, then we have to break up, is that people say if one drop of blood falls in, menstrual or otherwise, then the whole bucket is najis. But I would still consider it water. Can I make wudu with it? The opinion of the majority of the scholars, not majority, but many of them, I would say, is that it is najis, okay? But the correct opinion is that it is not najis, it is makruh to make wudu from that water. So you see, it is not haram, that water, but it comes makruh. Okay, if it's a small amount of water. So if a person is forced to perform wudu with that type of water, or he performs it unknowingly, suppose there's two buckets, okay, and he performs wudu from one of the buckets on the right-hand side, and then someone came and says, oh, I know my little child urinated in that bucket, okay. Now, he didn't notice any change in the scent or the color or the taste, okay. So he doesn't have to repeat his wudu. Okay, he doesn't have to repeat his wudu. So we're saying it is discouraged from performing wudu in this type of water, but it does not become najis according to the correct opinion of the scholars. This is because the Prophet said that water is tahur and it doesn't become najis. It doesn't become najis until one of these three things are changed. Okay? So water is tahur and it does not become najis. That's the hadith. And by ijma' or by consensus of the scholars, we say it doesn't become najis until one of these three things are changed. So to answer the question of the sister, it is water and you can make wudu from these type of waters. Do we have time for this? If a lady discretes clear discharge, does she need to change her undergarments? And if she wears panty liners which protect undergarments, will it suffice to replace it with a wash? Wallahi, sister, this type of fluid, there's a big ikhtilaf over two. This type of clear discharge, we're not talking about pre-seminal fluid. We're not talking about the discharge that is released in a state of excitement. We're not talking about that. That is najis by ijma', by consensus of the scholars. From what I understand, the sister is referring to clear discharges, which is common amongst women and very rare amongst men. This is just clear discharges that occurs. According to the majority, once again, it would be qualified as najis, according to the majority. So therefore, you would have to, at least, you don't have to change your undergarments, at least you have to wash it with water. You don't have to change it, but you have to wash with water. If you have panty liners, then you don't have to. It doesn't go to the undergarments, so you don't have to change the undergarments. Okay, so it'll suffice if you just replace it. Okay. Now I do know of some ulama, like Sheikh Uthaymeen, he has a condition. He said if the woman is well known for having a lot of discharge, okay, and that's suppose she does wudu. After 10 minutes, she's going to have another discharge. Another. And she can't possibly go into wudu every 5-10 minutes. In this case, Shaykh Uthaymeen says that she should wear, for example, a panty liner or something that's going to protect that discharge from spreading to her clothes. Do wudu as latest as possible before the salah. Suppose the salah starts at 1 o'clock. She should do wudu at like 12:50, 12:55. And then whatever happens after that, ignore it. Okay? This is what Shaykh Uthaymeen says. The reason being that this type of fluid, since it comes out from the private parts, in general it is najis. But because of the fact that she's having so much discharge, she can't control it. So she takes on the status of the one who continually urinates. Okay, there are some type of people, and we seek Allah's refuge, and we thank Him for being saved from this type of disease. There are some type of people, as you all know, they cannot control their urine. So they have to wear special padded garments to protect themselves. Okay, these type of people, because they can't control their urine, because it is beyond their control, it's a type of necessity that the scholars say, okay, they should wear something tight so that the urine doesn't spread to the masjid, and they should do wudu at the latest time possible, and then come and pray and ignore what happens after that. But obviously, they have to do a new wudu for every salah. So even if they didn't break their prayer, their wudu, but that fluid was continually coming out, as soon as they finish zuhr, when the time for asr comes, they have to make another wudu. Okay, because it's continual najis coming out. So Shaykh Uthaymeen says that if you have a lot of discharge, this is the hukum. If you have a little bit of discharge, then no. Yani once every 2 hours, then no. In this case, you know, it's safer for you to wash your undergarments and cleanse yourself and then do wudu again.